So, welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod, episode 38. So, we're off and running again.
And still on time.
Yes.
Even if I did have to battle a huge amount of traffic to get here.
Oh, yes, Goodwood Festival of Speed.
Yeah. Should have taken the train.
But... Oh, the schoolboy era that was, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there we go. We're here. We're on time. I don't think we have any catch-up today.
I don't think I have any at all. The weather's been so rubbish.
Yeah, I've actually sadly not been out of my camera for quite some time because apart from being busy, the weather has just been grim. We're not having a summer this year.
No, we don't appear to be having a summer. And of course, we did try to get out to play tennis. And
it went very wrong.
Blowing an absolute gale. And I pulled my groin. But apart from that, I think that's it, really.
It's pretty much all we've
done. I don't think people are really interested in hearing about my pulled groin, but I thought I'd throw that in anyway. It was important to me.
Yeah. So in that case, we might as well just dive straight into the episode.
Yes.
And this week we're going to be talking about rivers, which is a massive topic. And we've already covered species, sort of rivery species before. We've done a water vole episode. We've done an eel episode. This is a much more general chat, and we're focusing quite a lot on just why they're important for wildlife. I think after last week's or the previous episode being a bit of a more serious and heavier topic,
Yeah. We
know, and I'm sure everybody knows, that our rivers aren't necessarily in a great space, but we're not focusing on the negatives today. We just want to talk a little bit about some cool wildlife that rivers support.
Yeah, I think for people that like us, and I'm sure lots of people walking down rivers and alongside rivers all of the time, it's the wildlife and the flora and fauna and maybe, you know, people are unaware just the extent of the biodiversity that a river supports. And
yeah,
that's what we wanted to just have a little chat about today.
Yeah, and we've sort of divided it up by the name of the podcast and our photographic sort of preferences, with you covering some birds and myself covering some invertebrates. I will say that I got a bit overwhelmed by just how many invertebrates there were. So rather than going too general, I've actually got one or two cool case studies that
I there was a few more invertebrates than there are birds, I think.
Just had.
I think I when I was doing my research, and obviously I know quite a lot about birds that reside and you know, thrive and live near or on rivers, or by rivers. I think I got to about 45 species in the UK that spend a lot of time around rivers. How many thousands of invertebrates did you get? I think I've got a stat there. You know, I like a stat. I think I've got a stat that, hold on.
Well, while you're looking for it, it just makes me think of the fact that whilst the macro photography that I like to do becomes very quiet and not so interesting during the winter, when we go out together in the summer, we always make the joke that I can probably find more species in one bush than you can throughout the whole day.
Yeah, absolutely. My stat, which I have now found, there are over 4,000 species of freshwater invertebrates in the UK.
Yeah, so because of that, I sort of scrapped the general overview idea and I got some case studies, which I thought would be quite cool. Just before we kick it off, I think anybody who's listened to any episode that we've ever done is probably aware that I work for the Rivers Trust. I just have to put the caveat out there, both personally and professionally, that I am just here as me. I'm not here as a Rivers Trust employee. So everything I say and all the views are my own and not those of the organisation.
Yeah, much as we joke that, you know, we always get a Rivers Trust plug into virtually every episode, even if we're not talking about rivers.
I'll find a way.
We find a way. This is definitely just
Matthew.
Just us talking about why we love rivers and why, you know, why we love the wildlife that thrive around rivers.
Yeah, so I just thought I would throw that out there, that I'm not here on official job duty, just...
Okay, so shall we crack on? I didn't know, it's almost like I feel like this next bit is almost like standing in front of a classroom of 10-year-olds saying, right, children, what are rivers? How do you define a river?
We should probably start with a definition.
But I wanted to do that, the actual definition of a river. Do you want to do that?
No, you should go ahead.
So I've got the definition of a river. A river is a moving body of water that drains the land. That's the official description of a river. It flows from its source on high ground, across land, and then into another body of water, which could be a lake, could be an ocean, could be another river. It flows along a channel, has banks on both sides, and a bed at the bottom.
Yeah, it's nice and succinct.
That's
easy,
not bad,
to understand.
Is it? They usually begin in upland areas where rain falls on high ground, begins to flow downhill. They always flow downhill because of gravity.
That's key stage one.
Key stage one.
I mean, it's better than the definition I gave while we were doing the sound test. Rivers are wet.
Yes, rivers are very wet. Well, mostly they're wet.
Yeah. That's the definition done. What I wanted to do was kick it off with a little bit of just a few stats anyway about why they're so important. You've mentioned, obviously, we're focusing on the wildlife, but the actual facts and figures around them is, I think, they're extraordinary in the sense that despite covering less than 1% of Earth's surface, they are home to a third of described species of vertebrate.
Yeah, but that's quite significant, isn't it?
A huge amount when just from a percentage of, let's say, land covered to species supported. And the one that I found sort of mental, although I think there is an argument that, we haven't explored all the depths of our oceans, so maybe this fact is because of some of our, lack of understanding. But apparently they support approximately 40% of all fish.
Wow.
Although I think I should caveat that, that's freshwater habitat, so that does include things like lakes and stuff.
Yeah.
But 40%, when you think of how much of the Earth is ocean, I think that is a crazy
that's
number.
That's why they're so important.
but that sort of disproportionality, which I think is a great word, of biodiversity supported rivers, that's a global stat, but it obviously is reflected in our UK rivers as well. The fact that they are home to around 10% of all of our species here in the UK,
which is great.
Incredible.
That's why we love them.
Yeah. To be fair, we are quite a river-heavy nation, I think, as far as
Do you want a stat about that?
Give me a stat.
There are about 1,500 rivers in the UK, most of them being very small, but there are some major, I think there's about 30 or 35 major, what you call a major river, with significant length to them. So, but 1,500... rivers, about 90,000 kilometres in total that cover all parts of the country. So that's quite a lot of rivers.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Yeah.
I've got 200,000 kilometres of watercourses, but that includes things like canals and stuff as well. I think one of the reasons why rivers are such diverse areas as far as the number of species that they can support is the fact that rivers themselves are incredibly diverse. So we've given a general definition, but obviously like a short section of a river could feature small pools, riffles, which I like as a word, but
it's a great word, isn't
it's
it? I thought that was just to do with the way that you shuffle a pack of cards, but
a riffle shuffle. It's a shallow water flowing quickly over stones is a riffle.
Yeah.
You've also got submerged vegetation, you've got the riverbanks, you've got things like floodplains and wetlands. So when we say river, obviously we're referring to the flowing water, but the number of habitats associated with rivers themselves is obviously a large reason behind why they can support such a variety of creatures, which makes covering them from a general point of view quite tricky because there's a lot we could talk about. In fact, I think a lot of the things that we do talk about today could have easily had their own episode, and I think in the future we probably will again pick out more river species to highlight in more detail.
I think this has to be a sort of overview of rivers and why they're important,
because one case study,
because as you say that we could do an episode on lots of different bits of rivers and the species. That's an interesting thing that you say about the way that rivers obviously meander and they're much better.
Well, I should wave you to say Oxbow Lake.
No, I'm not going to say Oxbow Lake. That's a bit of a family joke about...
That's the only geography knowledge.
The only thing I could remember from geography was an Oxbow Lake, or what was it? An abandoned meander and an Oxbow Lake. It's the only thing I could remember about... I'll call it GCSE geography.
Yeah, as soon as you say meander.
But... obviously, over the sort of 1,000 years of change since we've been using rivers for all sorts of reasons, particularly in the past for transporting goods and people and materials and what have you, we've straightened out a lot of those rivers, which is funnily enough that we'll go on to some of the restoration things at success stories. And one of the things that in those restoration projects is to actually unstraighten rivers.
Re-wiggle
rivers, because rivers are much better with bends and areas where, where catchment areas effectively, where the flow of the river slows down and it supports.
Yeah, and you get build-up of different
and silt
materials.
Exactly. So we've straightened a lot out and now we're trying to re-wiggle them. So,
which is, again, a great term, re-wiggling.
Yeah, I'm not sure that is an official term, but it sounds okay to me.
I think the other thing, as far as the UK rivers go, is one of the reasons why they're so important is our chalk streams. And chalk streams are an incredible habitat. They're internationally important. They're sometimes referred to as like England's rainforests as far as the biodiversity and value of...
We seem to have most of them in the world.
Yeah, we really do. So there's about 210 chalk streams in the world, and I think 170 of them are in England, so it's like 85%, with the rest being in northern France, so not that far away. I call them the rainforest. I think they're normally called our Great Barrier Reef, which is a little bit more fitting being underwater, but essentially these are habitats fed from an sort of alkaline aquifer in chalk, and obviously we have a lot of chalkland. We've got like the South Downs, for example, and they're normally characterized by sort of gravel and flint beds and really, really clear water.
Just so you know, and I'm sure people do, an aquifer means it's able to soak up and hold water. So chalk is an aquifer, which means it can hold water, a bit like a sponge.
Yeah, this is Dad in Dictionary Corner.
I'd just like to clarify this.
Yeah,
it's
an important
Not everybody might know what an aquifer is.
No, I just wanted to make the countdown.
It's actually
joke.
A word I really like, aquifer. Anyway.
But the chalk streams, again, are another reason why, in particular, the UK has such a high value on their river systems and something that greatly needs protecting.
Yes, and the chalk streams, because of their very nature, means they're really rich in minerals.
Yeah.
So, especially calcium, apparently. So, and that supports a really distinctive
set
biodiversity
of
and
flora and fauna.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think you've done your normal little cultural references as well, haven't you?
I've got a few. I've got a few nice
before we
facts,
delve into the wildlife.
Which I guess one of them actually I hadn't thought about until I was doing the research. But then, of course, it makes a huge amount of sense that most of the capital cities in the world were built on or near rivers, and I guess that does make sense.
Isn't it?
Exactly. So it gave settlers access to obviously fresh water and transportation for trade. Then I've got I was reading a little bit about how some of them got named, and there are some great names of some of the rivers. I've got this little sentence here: the Mees, the Tees, the Dee, the Cree, the Chess, the Pang, and the Clun, the Piddle, and the Polly, the Box, the Yox, and the Yeo are all little rivers, and most of them get their names from either Celtic or pre-Roman era, and sometimes even earlier. And invariably the names were given to rivers just because of the word meant water or had some reference to water. There's quite a lot of repetition. There are quite a lot of Avons, because Avon means river in Welsh. There are five in England, three in Scotland, and one in Wales. So there's five Ouses, which take their name from the Celtic word for water, as does the Ewer and the Weir and the Wye and the Don. So when you look back historically, a lot of the river names came from a particular dialect and a word that meant water.
It's not very imaginative, is it? Just
no, but it makes
water,
sense,
but it
doesn't
make
it?
Sense.
Yeah, so that's really all the cultural stuff that I've done.
Before we jump into the wildlife, shall we just give some quick UK river facts?
You made me a little bit nervous because you said you've got a quiz.
Oh, no, your quiz is something way harder.
Oh, excellent. And actually, sadly, I've already quizzed you pre this research on which is the longest river in England.
Which is the Severn.
Which is the Severn, which is 220 miles, which is the deepest.
Thames.
Which again
makes sense for, certainly for transporting all the goods and stuff. It's a useful feature for our capital city.
Have you got
city.
Any more you want to add?
I've got the shortest being the Mora, which I think is only 1,000 yards or just over a mile long. And we've already covered how many being 1,500 rivers.
And we all know which is the longest river in the world.
Yes, of course we do.
Don't we?
Yeah, it's the Amazon.
No, it's not.
No, it's the... it's the one in Africa that runs through Egypt.
Yes.
But I can't think of it. The Nile.
The Nile.
There we go. I couldn't think of its name.
I think there was always a bit of a controversy about which was the longest between the Nile and the Amazon.
I think the Amazon is longer if you take into consideration all of its tributaries.
Yeah.
But not from single source to sea.
Yeah.
I think that's correct. I think it's if you look at the river system that is the Amazon, it's insane.
Anyway, it's an awful lot longer than the River Severn.
Yeah, and the Mora. I can't believe how long it took me to remember the name Nile.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, that's fine. I only focus on the UK rivers. All right, let's move into some of the wildlife-y stuff.
Okay.
Do you want to kick it off with some bird things? As the part of the birdie bug pod.
I think for me, I see such a rich diversity of birds that are in or around rivers feeding or nesting or residing around rivers. And there are some that maybe, I mean, there's the obvious ones that people always think about, like the kingfishers and little egrets and grey herons.
Mallards.
And obviously all of the waterfowl, like the ducks and the mute swans. Those are ones that, that are sort of commonplace that people would naturally assume. But there are ones that maybe people wouldn't. For example, they're a really, really important food supply source for insectivorous birds like swifts and swallows and house martins. So those are migratory birds that come in, and they're feeding off the surface and of the insect life that are around rivers all of the time. And maybe that's something that people wouldn't be so accustomed to seeing.
Wouldn't necessarily associate with them. Yeah. And I think that's part of the point of this episode, apart from it just being a nice thing to chat about after, say, a slightly heavier research topic last time, is the fact that, I mean, most people, well, certainly myself, you think water, birds, ducks, and I mean kingfishers are iconic,
and kingfishers, of course,
obviously, I mean, they should be, they look like they've come out of the tropics, they're stunning, but it's the sheer variety of animals, even beyond those that actually live on the water, that rivers support. I mean, you can go back and listen to our episode on bats, for example, and again, just like swifts and swallows, bats will come down and feed on insects emerging from the water. They'll also use them as highways for navigation. Even things like grass snakes, although grass snakes typically are more sort of pondy, but they love a wetland and a river because they eat fish and they eat amphibians and stuff like that. So it's all these animals that maybe you don't think, oh yeah, that's a river species, and yet they rely so heavily on our waterways.
Yeah, and there are also things that I guess again that people might not be so familiar about, but I do remember. If any of you watch Spring Watch or Winter Watch, you'll know that Chris Packham he loves the bird of prey, particularly sparrowhawks. He's really, really fond of sparrowhawks. And they will use rivers going through woodlands. And in fact, I remember seeing an episode of either one of those, and I can't remember whether it was Spring or Winter Watch, where they had some fantastic film of a buzzard on the sort of the shallow part of a river that was winding its way through the forest, and washing its feathers and taking a bath, and they will use those rivers for that a lot. And of course, people I don't think would associate that either. Think of a big bird of prey coming down and having a good wash in a river, and that's what they would use them for. Also, we have a lot of migratory birds that come in various parts of the year. They'll come in the winter, and obviously the ones will come in for the spring for breeding. And a lot of those birds have travelled vast distances. I mean, we're talking thousands of miles. And water is a hugely important resource as soon as they get here. So they'll come straight in and they'll make a beeline. Or if they're passage migrants, which means that they're coming across, moving across the UK to get to a northerly or southerly location, they will stop over, and obviously they'll refuel, but they'll also need water, and so it's used a huge amount for migratory birds.
Just little pit stops, aren't they?
Little pit stops, exactly that. So, and the other thing that maybe people don't or maybe not so aware of is that when I'm walking down alongside a river that is bedecked by reed beds and long grasses, there are so many little birds that
all
reside.
The little warblers and
warblers in particular. So you've got reed warblers and sedge warblers and Chetty's warblers.
You can never see them.
And they use it. They use those reed beds for nesting, for feeding, for protection, because they are more protected in there from predation. And it's an absolute cacophony of noise when you walk down the river.
Fantastic sounds.
And often you don't see them. I really struggle to photograph them half the time because they're literally bobbing around inside all the reeds and the rushes. But it's such a wonderful sound. I mean, you've walking down a
also
river.
Got things like the iconic sound of a booming bittern.
And I've got bittern on
like
my
that.
List here, because a bittern, which is a part of the heron family.
And they must have been, and maybe we should do an episode on bitterns, but they're in Southampton. They must have been prevalent at one point, because we've got Bittern Park, yeah. We've got a pub called Bittern.
Yeah.
They're actually dotted about on sign stuff everywhere.
Well, again, they became very threatened and yeah. very, you know, their population absolutely... fell through the floor.
An iconic species.
And I've yet to get a real decent photograph. I've never heard one booming, yeah. because they're, again, in particular parts of the country, tend to be a little bit more Norfolk, Suffolk, yeah. and in the Midlands and around yeah. there. But so there are, again, I could talk about birds all day long, but all I'm going to effectively do is list them. There are lots of little waders, sandpipers, oyster catchers. And again, one of the most charismatic ones and characteristic ones, really, is, again, a bird I haven't seen and I'm desperate to, is a dipper.
Yeah.
Which is such a beautiful, fabulous birds. Little bird. If you watch a dipper bobbing Dip. About and then dipping in the water, again, I've seen lots of film of it. I've never seen one, live to photograph, because, again, I don't get them down in my part of the world very much. So for me, bird life around the rivers is so varied.
I mean, to be fair, I think historically a lot of our photography, even before I specialised sort of towards macro, but even more now, we always end up somewhere wet.
Yeah,
it's always wetlands or yeah. river habitat, yeah. because it just, again, sort of hitting the same drum, it's just so biodiverse.
Yeah.
There's so much there for us yeah. to see. We're sort of spoilt for choice, aren't we?
Yeah, so, you know, you can walk down a river and see such a variety of bird life, and for me that's just a joy. And of course we're not going to concentrate, as we said, at all. We're not even going to touch on really why our rivers are struggling.
I've got a slight note at the end, but
and that's why, you know, but that's why rivers are so important for me in particular, as a bird photographer. There's wonderful things for supporting a bird life, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, beyond that, for me, I love paddle boarding,
yeah.
and wild swimming and all that sort of, so there's all sorts of other reasons why people who maybe aren't necessarily attached to the wildlife side of things can appreciate and enjoy
yeah.
a river.
I mean, the sight of a kingfisher fishing in a river is just one of those beautiful,
yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it,
stunning things to watch. That is just, yeah, incredible. So that's really, say, I could list all the birds, I'm not going to. But rivers, let's just leave it that rivers are hugely important in every country, but in this country for supporting bird life.
Okay, well, I see I've gone down a slightly different tack, and I've got a very specific organism that I thought I'd introduce you to. I was going to do some sort of general information on invertebrates and insects and things yeah. like that, and then, as we've already stated, there are a lot of them. And so I wasn't too sure how I could do it justice, so instead I picked a couple that I thought would be an interesting talking point. To be fair, the main one doesn't typically fall under what we'd call a bug. It is an invertebrate, but it's not an insect or anything like that. But I wanted to talk about the freshwater pearl mussel.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that, and I know absolutely yeah, nothing about them.
I got a bit distracted and went down a rabbit hole, and they could have easily been a full episode, but instead I'll just give you a quicker case study on them. I'll butcher the scientific name. It's Margaritifera, so it's the same word twice, which means at least I can only butcher it once. But what's really cool is they're actually one of the longest living invertebrates in the world, with a lifespan that can over 100 years. The
wow.
oldest one was caught in Europe in Estonia.
Really, 100 years?
And it was aged to be 134 years old.
Is that because they're so sedentary?
Just
or?
A very long living creature.
Yeah.
But yes, they are sedentary. So obviously being a mussel and therefore a mollusk, they've got that big foot, like
yeah.
a snail,
yeah.
essentially. But I think everybody sort of knows what a mussel looks like. But they're really interesting. They are, I say, one of the oldest invertebrates in the world, but they're also a keystone species, an indicator species, and incredibly endangered, sadly, now. They used to be very abundant, but they've been sort of fished and harvested, both for...
There's a surprise.
The fact that we could eat them, but also, yeah. you know, pearls is,
yeah.
is the other reason. But their populations in the UK have always been really important. More than half of the world's population exists in Scotland. Although the Scottish populations have also been hit quite hard. And again, I'm not going to go too much into the sort of sadder side of the population of freshwater pearl mussels, but I really just want to talk about how interesting their life cycle is, because it's, I don't know, it's just baffling or just really quite niche. And so the adults live very much as you would expect a mussel to live. They sort of attach themselves to the riverbed and they filter water, which is, again, one of the reasons why they're so important, with an adult mussel filtering about 50 litres of water a day, which again means that they can improve the water quality for other species. So they're really important for just creating a nice clean habitat for all the other animals that live in the river. However, the young mussels do not live like that. And one of the reasons why they're actually endangered and struggle is they need a really good, healthy population of sort of salmon and trout. So obviously as fish numbers
kind of tells you everything,
decreased, it's impacted the mussel population. But reason why is that the mussel larvae are ejected en masse once sort of fertilization has happened. The female ejects all these mussel larvae, about 4 million of them, and they then go and attach to the gills of Atlantic salmon and trout. So they essentially get inhaled by the fish and then they close their shell and attach to the gills. Doesn't impact the fish in any way, but they just hitch a ride on this fish for a while. And they live on that fish for about 10 months out of the year, growing in quite a nice oxygen-rich environment. The larvae are actually called glochidia, and they literally just resemble tiny, tiny mussels, with obviously a shell that's held open until they latch on. One of the reasons why they have to release, you know, 4 million larvae at a time is that the chances of them latching onto a fish at the right time is quite low. So a lot of the larvae just get swept out and won't survive. So it's really a quantity over quality sort of situation. So they spend 10 months just sort of hitching a ride on a fish, and then eventually they will drop off. And so after this normally happens about July, September, they latch on to a fish sort of May, June. And then it's 10 months later and into the next year. And once they fall off, they hopefully land in what should be nice, pristine, healthy river habitat. Obviously, one of the reasons they struggle is our rivers aren't healthy, but they drop off the fish and then they sort of just bury themselves into the gravel. And for the next 3 to 5 years, they will just sort of rasp, use their foot to gather algae and bacteria from the gravel as they develop their gills. So they're not actually filter feeding for the first 3 to 5 years, they're just growing and developing, and then they mature. They actually don't reach sexual maturity until 10 to 15 years. So it's really, really long life cycle.
Yeah.
And I don't think I ever thought of mussels going through such a different stage of life. I always just thought of small mussels filter feeding.
Yeah.
You've got them living on the gills for 10 months, then surviving off algae and bacteria for 3 to 5 years, and then they start filter feeding. So it's just a whole world that I had no idea existed.
Fascinating.
This little mollusk. And then they reach sexual maturity 10 to 15 years, and here is where your quiz is coming.
Oh,
so
no.
I've given you a few stats.
Go on then. Is it a multiple choice so I can actually go on then?
They eject, 4 million larvae. Yeah. They hit sexual maturity 10 to 15 years. Their reproductive lifespan is about 75 years. Okay. Right. So how many larvae do you reckon they produce in their lifetime? A, 50 million, B, 100 million, C, 150 million, or D, 200 million?
Well, I think on that basis, I think it's got to be 150 or 200. So I think it's going to be C.
No, it is D. It's 200 million, okay. 200 million larvae in their lifetime, which is just...
That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge.
Can you imagine having 200 million children?
Sounds expensive. But yeah, so that was the main part of the fact. I just found, I had no idea that baby mussels latch onto the gills of salmon and trout and live like that for 10 months. Which
I
wonder really
why
cool.
evolution did that.
Clearly it was useful
There was a reason why it started doing that.
I know we plan to talk a little bit about sort of conservation and good stories around rivers. Yeah. And I've got some of that for the freshwater pearl mussel, because obviously I've said they used to be very abundant and they're now really quite threatened, to the point where 90% decline in the populations in the UK in the last century. So they've declined a lot. They're in the IUCN Red List, and all the normal reasons: pollution, sediment. Sediment's particularly bad because it actually suffocates the juvenile mussels when they're buried on the bed. What they want is nice gravelly riverbeds. But obviously anything that reduces the population of the fish that they rely so heavily on for their reproduction. Not going into the problems too much, the conservation. And obviously I've stuck my caveat out there that I'm not here on Rivers Trust duty and I'm here as myself. However, a lot of the freshwater pearl mussel conservation projects are done by local Rivers Trust, so I do sort of need to highlight them. I've just got two that I'll go through really quickly. One is a project that's led by North Wales Rivers Trust, obviously up in North Wales. You mentioned the naming of rivers. It's Afon Eden.
Right.
Obviously, we've also got an Eden somewhere else in the UK.
Yeah.
My geography is very bad. Again, that river's had a variety of problems with it being straightened and just all sorts of issues with things like cattle having unrestricted access to the river and temperatures going up due to a lack of shade and things like that. And since this project began in 2022, so far it has installed 4 kilometres of fencing, preventing livestock from disrupting the river, planted 500 native trees, and essentially implemented tons of river-rounded gravel, which creates the ideal habitat not only for the juvenile mussels and adult mussels, but also for fish spawning as well.
Yeah.
So it's really important for bringing those fish back to the river. And the reason why I thought I'd highlight this project is that this year, 2 years after the project started, a survey found juvenile fish like salmon and sea trout. And so it's a really good sign that the river's bouncing back and becoming healthier. And then the very last bit on the mussels, and then I'll leave them alone, is that there's a really cool breeding program by the Ballanderry Rivers Trust in Northern Ireland. And essentially, this Rivers Trust has been at the forefront of pearl conservation or pearl mussel conservation in Northern Ireland since 1998. And there's all sorts of stats I could rattle off, but I'll just do the fact that essentially a survey in 2017 of about 47 kilometre stretch of the river revealed that only 1,400 mussels remained and no juveniles were found. So it wasn't in the best of state. And the breeding programme is now one of the largest population reinforcement projects in Europe. And over the years, it has more than doubled wild populations by releasing 3,000 mussels into the river.
Ah, okay.
So it's a huge amount.
Yeah.
And every year, between 200 and 300 juveniles are released to try and bolster the sort of younger generation of mussels. And what's really cool is this program is not only still growing, but they're working really closely with farmers and local stakeholders to actually improve the habitat and water quality to sort of keep the longevity of those mussels that have been released. And it's just really cool to see that one of the largest sort of reintroduction or reinforcement projects in Europe is happening in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, that is really good. And I have to say, you just mentioning farmers, we're seeing more and more when we're talking about these success stories and conservation projects, and whether it be rivers or whatever, is that isn't it great to hear that
they're getting involved.
More and more farmers are getting involved and wanting to help. And I think that's such a positive thing.
Yeah,
such
I mean,
positive thing.
They've always had that.
Because, you know, they're managing the land, a huge amount of the land in this country.
Yeah, and I think farmers have always been called, like, the stewards of the land. And they have always been that.
Yeah.
But obviously, the land is facing a very specific set of problems now, and they have to be part of the solution because, like you say, they are in
they
control.
Have to be, but they don't have to be.
Yeah.
And they are.
We need them
to be. We need them to be. And I'm finding it so encouraging to hear that they want to help. They want to get involved. They want to find out how they can still be commercially successful, which of course they need to be, but they can help, you know, with protecting biodiversity and helping conservation projects that are near or on their land. And I think that's such a positive thing. It's such a good thing to hear.
Yeah.
Cool.
So to get involved in trying to help the freshwater pearl mussel. And obviously you have to think that the mussels, again, improve water quality for everything else.
Yeah.
So it's one of those where if you can start with them, make sure the habitat's suitable for them, they then help us improve it for
It's a bit
the
like
fish
beavers, isn't it? We did a thing about the beavers on reintroduction episode that we did, and we're not going to mention beavers on this episode because we did
They
do
get
that.
A few mentions, actually, don't they?
But it's exactly the same thing. If you let them
do their work,
and do their thing, then actually they're really beneficial. Yeah.
But the reason why, apart from the fact I got distracted by how cool their life cycle is, I think, again, when we think of animals in the river, we maybe don't think of mussels.
Yeah, and yet, absolutely, I didn't.
One of the longest living invertebrates in the world.
I think that's incredible, 100 years.
Some of the most important populations have historically been supported here in the UK.
That's a quiz question you should have asked me.
How old?
Yeah, because I'd have never guessed 100 years. I'd have said 10 or something.
So. They haven't even hit sexual maturity by incredible. 10. It's incredible. Yeah. So just, I got a bit distracted.
Understandably.
By mussels and...
You know, the one thing I didn't do an awful lot of, which I'm now realising I should have done, albeit, you know, I wanted to concentrate a little bit on the birds, was the flora and fauna that are supported and grow in rivers, grow around and near rivers. Have you got anything on flora
my
and fauna?
Other, I've got some on river flies, but not, I didn't go
because
down
Because, of course,
the
there's route. A huge amount of flora and fauna. That maybe is another episode.
Yeah. I'm conscious of how long I spoke about mussels. But I have another case study, if you want to know.
Oh, no, do go on. I mean, to be honest, you are a river man, aren't you? So I feel like you should be talking more.
Well, I chose this one because I felt like whilst the mussels were cool, they didn't really fit under my normal buggy umbrella.
Yeah.
So I thought I should probably talk about some insects. And we always talk about citizen science. And these insects come with a cool citizen science project, so I thought it was a nice little linkage between topics that we like.
Yeah.
So river flies can really refer to a whole bunch, but in the context that I'm using the word river flies, it refers to three groups of insects, and that is the stoneflies, caddisflies, and upwing mayflies.
Yeah.
I have to specify upwing mayflies because it's a bit of a weird one where mayflies is used interchangeably with upwing flies, even though the true mayfly is a specific species, which is Ephemera danica. I don't know if that's how you say that. And so when you say mayfly, really what you talk about is one species, but people sort of use it as an umbrella term. Anyway, these three groups of insects are really key indicators of river health and are actually sometimes called sort of the canaries of our river. If their populations start dropping, you know something is wrong.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact they spend pretty much their whole life cycle in and around water, like a lot of insects, their larvae live in water. I mean, we could have covered things like dragonflies and damselfly larvae and all that sort of stuff. But they're also really important food sources for other species. I mean, we've spoken about how insects are sort of at the bedrock of a lot of ecosystems, and so things like birds and bats and fish
of course,
we haven't even touched on fish, all eat these, whether the larvae or the adults. But what's really cool is that these three flies are being used now as an indicator of river health. And before I go into that, I'd love to have gone into detail on each group, but instead I've just got like three facts for each of them. So for example, we've got 51 species of upwing or mayflies in the British Isles, but they are unique because they are the only insect to be known to have two adult life stages. So obviously they've got the larva, but then they go to what's called a sub-imago, or a dun, and then they develop again into an imago. And I don't even know if I'm saying that word right, and I should be, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Or a spinner. And so most insects you think of having a, you know, like a larvae, then they pupate into an adult.
Yeah.
But mayflies actually have two adult life stages, which is really cool. And with fossils dating back over 300 million years, mayflies are actually some of the oldest known winged insects in existence.
That's a great
fact. Again, is fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating. 300 million years. Yeah. Wow.
Old lineage.
Stoneflies. And they've probably changed very little over that period. Yeah.
I always think back to like Jurassic Park when you see like the insects in amber and stuff.
Apart from the fact they might be four times the size.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether insects were actually.
Well, no, the giant dragonfly, I think, is one of the coolest prehistoric animals in existence.
Was it
big? They are huge. They have meter-long wingspan. Wow. It's a dragonfly.
That's incredible.
Insane. Yeah. It's just a much... higher oxygen content in the air, essentially, I think is one of the reasons why things like invertebrates could reach such impressive sizes.
I'm pretty sure that a hobby wouldn't have been able to catch that in the air.
Might be reversed.
Yeah.
Stoneflies, unbelievably, you know, typically found in stony rivers.
Yeah.
34 species in the UK, and they're actually normally found crawling around on stones and vegetation rather in flight. And then the caddisflies, we've got 199 species. And the reason why they're cool is that some of the larvae actually make cases out of silk. And then they, it's almost like a little cocoon. And they'll decorate it with vegetation and stone and other bits of debris and stuff. And so they're really hard to find. They're like these little camouflaged cones of river debris. And inside you've got a little fly larvae, which is cool. They actually fly at night once they've grown into adults. And they're a key food source for bats.
Yeah.
The reason why I wanted to speak about these insects is that, like I said, they've become a key indicator for river health. And so there's a partnership called the Riverfly Partnership. It's hosted by the Freshwater Biological Association, and essentially it's a whole group of different volunteers all across the country who can get involved in citizen science, carry out surveys and look for riverfly larvae typically. And you do things like kick surveys, where you have a big net that you stick onto the bed of the river with the handle sticking up almost like a broom, and you kick the sediment and then it gets washed, everything under the sediment and the gravel gets washed into the net.
Yeah.
And then you tip the net into like a tray of water and you can see what you find.
Yeah.
And so you'll actually find the sort of activity that you can do with schools and stuff like that.
Pond dipping.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Volunteers are essentially trained in these surveys, carry out surveys at different times during the year. And by looking at changes in the sort of population health of these key flies, we can then see changes in overall river quality, identify areas that are clearly really struggling, maybe identify areas that are doing really well, and then work out, you know, why is that area doing so much better than elsewhere. But it's become a really important partnership and method for locating places to create and restore habitats, not only for the insects but then for the entire ecosystem, because they are so crucial for supporting the rest of the food chain. And it's again a nice, I think, thing to highlight. People may not really associate or be as interested in the little flies that you see sort of skating around underwater or flying around at night, and yet they're so important, not just for the ecosystem, but for our own understanding of river health now.
Yeah.
And if people want to get involved in it, I'll stick all the links down in the show notes. You can go and find an organisation near you. Some of them are rivers trusts, some of them are wildlife trusts, for example, and get involved in surveying riverfly species and contribute to this picture of river health.
And isn't it great really that people needed. Do that? Because
yeah. You know, it's a great way to spend an afternoon as well.
We
get your boots
we're
wet.
We're always talking about citizen science, and there are so many ways that you can get involved in citizen science.
Yeah.
And there's just, you know, there's one that perhaps you hadn't thought about
before.
And if
you've never spent an afternoon sort of with your wellies in a river.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's done pond dipping, and it's actually really fascinating. And it's obviously a, you know, it's the same kind of thing, but it's also really important data that you are helping to provide. And, you know, it's really important.
What's cool.
And even more so at this current time for reasons that we all know about. So
What's cool, I think, about these projects is I've said obviously they work quite well for like school kids, and so again it's being used as a way of introducing people to the life that you can find in a river and getting people invested in these sorts of issues at a much earlier age. And again, I mean, a lot of my childhood was spent pond dipping or rock pooling, and I think it does form a real passion for the natural world, because it's like a whole other.
Perhaps we should get Kia to come and do a bit.
Wait, who?
Kia Starmer.
Oh.
Yeah, so possibly. I shouldn't have put that in. We don't get political.
No, we're
Kia, come and do some. What's it called? Come and do some
riverfly survey.
Riverfly survey.
Yeah. Anyway,
I'll cut that bit out.
I could have easily talked. I've done a whole episode on just caddisflies or mayflies, and I've sort of gone through that somewhat rapidly.
And of course, there are lots and lots of other wildlife. Lots of mammals rely on rivers, from water voles to otters, beavers, as we know.
We haven't even spoken about fish.
We haven't spoken about fish. And of course, talking about fish, obviously salmon comes to mind. You know, they need clean gravel.
We did
gravel.
An episode on salmon, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, clean gravel. Have we? Clean gravel to spawn on. I don't know if we have, actually.
Or did we do? We did eels.
We did eels. And often, again, the health of a river can be determined by salmon, the presence of salmon coming up the rivers to spawn. And often they can't go up to their spawning grounds because the rivers have been silted up.
Or
and
blocked by dams. Blocked and by dams.
Yeah, absolutely that.
I think at some point, again, we're always at risk of me becoming a Rivers Trust podcast, is we should probably at some point do an episode on the problems facing rivers and things like that. They have
think we should.
They have popped up in episodes like, for example, like you mentioned, salmon migrating, eels migrate. Yeah. So they suffer from a lot of the same problems.
Same problems.
When we look at health of the habitat and things, water voles have had a real issue, although obviously the mink is also a big part of that, but you can go and listen to a whole episode on that if you want to.
Yeah, I think we should do an episode on that, because as much as, you know, it's probably going to be a lot of doom and gloom, it's a really important thing to be talking about, you know, and making people aware of. People are very aware that our rivers are not in good state and they're not being looked after, but maybe people don't understand the significance of that. However, I think that may be a good time, we're talking about salmon, to go on to some positive news.
Okay.
Because the few positive examples that I've got of restoration projects for rivers include the success has been determined by salmon appearing in the river.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're quite high up on the food chain, and it's always, you know, once you've got those big animals, there must be a healthy ecosystem below them. Otherwise,
so I've got a couple of examples of that. There was a significant tributary of the River Dee, runs through the village of Torfins, I think it's pronounced, T-O-R-P-H-I-N-S, Torfins. And it's a site of a really large regeneration project that was completed in 2020. And it had changed in the years gone by. The river had been changed to almost into a canal for transporting, you know, goods, and often transported coal and stuff like that. And 1.5 kilometres of that river channel was straightened in the 1860s, in actual fact, to accommodate the Deeside Railway. What they've done is they've
re-wiggled
into a 2 kilometre river, with the channel being reconnected to 10 hectares of wetland. And cut a long story short, with no records of salmon spawning on this bit of river for 20 years, and probably none since the river was straightened, just weeks after the work was completed, 15 spawning salmon and sea trout were seen.
Oh, that's brilliant.
That was within weeks. So that was a really, really great success story. And like I say, often success stories of rivers revolve around the appearance of salmon, particularly Atlantic salmon. There's another one, River Derwent. For the first time in 100 years, Atlantic salmon were once again spawning in the upper waters of the River Derwent, which was a real, again, a big conservation success story. After centuries of intensive river management by the county's burgeoning factories, the fish were pretty much driven to extinction. And so what they've been doing is restoring it, cleaning it, removing weirs, which allow the salmon to recolonise at the headwaters. And for the first time in 100 years, Atlantic salmon were once again spawning. So again, like you said, it's often removing those obstacles for salmon to get through. They've been, lots of weirs were and dams were put in, and so that was a couple that I've got. I don't know if you've got any more.
Yeah, it's tricky again for me, because it's hard for me not to be biased, purely because a lot of my knowledge comes through the stuff I talk about every day, which means
it's your job.
I do end up promoting local Rivers Trusts, and again, I have to make it, I'm not here on Rivers Trust duty. However, the movement is also spread across all of the UK and Ireland, and a lot of these projects, even when they're big collaboration projects, do involve a local trust. So even if I wasn't working for them, they would still be getting a mention. So one of the big ones is, like you've mentioned, weirs and dams have caused quite a lot of problems, especially for our migratory species. And you've got projects all over the UK. I mean, there's been a really long project in the Don catchment, essentially called Living Heritage on the River Don. And that is essentially just working to try and open up these rivers that have been historically blocked by dams and weirs. I could rattle off all sorts of stats, but they've installed 5 fish passes on 5 weirs in Sheffield. In 2020, there was another completion of a fish pass. they've created what they're calling a migration superhighway from the sea up the Don through Sheffield and Alterbridge. Is that how you say it? Altbridge? Outbridge? I don't know how you say that place. But there are early indicators suggesting that the reopening is already working, with two salmon found in Sheffield in January 2019. And two may not seem like a lot, but that was the first record of salmon in Sheffield for over 200 years.
It does seem to be a thing, doesn't it, for river health, is to see salmon reappearing.
And again, it's like 200 years where they've been absent, and then suddenly they're reappearing. Yeah. If we want to stick on the sort of re-wiggling side of things, we've had lots of stuff actually happening not that far from us over in Lewis.
Oh, okay.
Again, a section of river has been re-wiggled, lots of wetland has been reconnected, and the sort of local community are getting involved in sort of surveying the wildlife again, which is brilliant, and they're seeing things like herons and egrets come
often back. Often that re-wiggling as well is starting to is a flood prevention action as well.
Yeah, it
is. So all of that is helping, because obviously we're getting a huge amount of flooding as climate change is changing our you know, our rainfall levels, let's say. So
and what's important to remember is that when you re-wiggle a river, you essentially slow the flow.
You slow the flow,
and so when you have heavy rainfall, instead of having all this water like rushing through the landscape, it can take a little bit more time, which gives the surrounding flood plains more time to absorb it. All sorts of things. So that is a bit of a like buzz phrase now, slow the flow. But I mean, I could just plug, go read the recent impact report that I played a part in writing, because it highlights some brilliant work that's been done to help our rivers across the last year, but by the Rivers Trust movement.
Yeah, actually, you need to go on the Rivers Trust site, because I know there's some great stuff on there.
But it's important to mention that a lot of these projects are very collaborative.
Yeah.
You've got local wildlife trusts, you've got local landowners.
Actually, WWF UK actually is also very instrumental in river restoration. And
yeah, so a lot of them are really collaborative. It's never one organisation. Same with every episode that we've ever done. All of the projects are these big joint efforts between organisations. And so I won't rattle off any more projects, but I will leave some links down to some cool things that have gone on, both recently and historically, if people want to go and see some of the work that's been done to protect rivers and things like that.
Yeah, and there's there's various organisations. River Action UK is another one. That we'll do a link to the various organisations and their websites to go on, you know, find out more about campaigns that are going on to save various rivers and work that's being done to protect the existing ones.
We'll also stick little things down there on how people can get involved. So
and I feel like science. You know, we've sort of generalised on the importance of rivers from our point of view more than anything else, from our, you know, love of bird life, invertebrates, but also just, you know, being on a river, walking down a river, breathing it in. You know, they're fabulous environments.
Yeah, fabulous habitats.
And habitats, and so important. And we literally could do another 10 episodes.
I think it's safe to say there will be more episodes on whether they're species-specific or problem-specific or solution-specific, I'm sure we'll cover more river topics.
We just wanted to show some river love.
Yeah, and I'm not going to apologise to get distracted by the mussels, because they're really cool.
No, that was fascinating.
But my general information got very tailored into a case study on mussels.
Yeah, no, it was good. That was good stuff. So I think we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
And like I say, watch out for more episodes on
And if you have a chance, rivers, when the weather's not so rubbish, go enjoy your local river.
Walk down the river,
see what wildlife you can spot.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool.
Great. Enjoyed that.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.